Hello, and welcome to the Book Speaks podcast, where the book speaks for itself. I'm your host, Benjamin Douglas, and this is the show where each week I read a chapter from a different indie author. Thanks for joining me for today's reading. Hi everybody, happy Friday, and thanks for joining me today for the 11th episode of the Book Speaks podcast, where the book speaks for itself. I am super excited for today's episode. Now, I know I say that every week, and to be fair, it's always true because I'm really enjoying doing the show, but it couldn't be more true today because today I'm reading from the one and only Mr. Chris Fox. Yeah, that's right. The author mentor, author numbers guru, YouTube personality, my own personal epithet for him, all around good guy, Mr. Chris Fox. So we're going to talk a little bit more about him in just a minute. But before we do, I want to make a very special announcement, something that's very exciting for me personally. Yesterday, I got the final edit finished on my mailing list magnet. Woo! It's a short story called The Trials of Io. Clocks in just over 7,000 words. You know, I was hoping to get about 10,000 to be able to call it a novelette. But I got to the end, and it was over. And because it's sort of an action-adventure with a lot of suspense in the sci-fi genre, I didn't want to monkey around with the pacing by adding padding. So there you go, about a 7,000 word short story. It is what it is, and what it is free. Whoa, yeah, because it's a mailing list magnet, right? So I'm going to drop a link in the show notes. You can also find it at my website, http://benjamindouglasbooks.wordpress.com. What you do is you sign up for my mailing list, and you get a free copy as either an EPUB or a MOBI file, your choice. You should be able to sideload those onto just about any reader you're using, and I'll have links to instructions for how to do that. If you're not super tech savvy, don't panic. It's going to be okay. We're going to get through it together. And like any mailing list, you'll be able to opt out at any time if you'd like to. That's fine. You can keep the short story, no hard feelings. But if you enjoy it, if you're a fan of science fiction, I'd encourage you to stay on the list. What I'm going to use this list for is sending out notifications for my new releases, such as when my current pre-order, The Lunar Gambit, Book 1 of the Starship Fairfax series, goes live on June 29th this year, 2017. You'll be notified of that. You'll be notified of general news in my author journey, concisely, and you'll probably be given an occasional cross-promotional option to buy something by another author. I'm not planning on sending out an email more than bi-weekly, unless I get myself in a situation where I'm part of a big promo and I absolutely have to send an email to my list, in which case I'll profusely apologize in the message. You should never get more than 2 messages per month. So no spamming, and of course I will not share your email address with anybody else. So yeah, check it out in the show notes or on my website. Free short story for my mailing list. Thank you so much to everyone who helped me put this together. I want to say a huge thank you to the authors, especially on K-Boards, who've helped me critique my cover and my blurb. A massive thank you to my editor. I love you. You know I do. And a thank you to just everyone who's encouraged me along the way, including Mr. Chris Fox, who helped me both indirectly through some of his own teaching material, I would say, in posts on K-Boards, for example, and also in his YouTube videos, which I'll mention again in a moment. And directly, he dropped in on a thread I had started about a year ago, year and a half now, I guess, on K-Boards, where I had issued myself a writing challenge, sort of in the fashion of his own writing challenge prior to that. And he dropped in and was just really cool and said, "Hey man, you're going to do this because you can." And I was so encouraged by that. And you know what? I actually failed miserably in that challenge. I got words down on the page, but they weren't the right words. You know what I mean? But it was an important learning experience for me. It was an important piece of the elephant that I had to eat to get to where I am now, which is on the cusp of releasing my debut novel. So, yeah, thanks, Chris. Really cool of you. Based on what I've heard about Chris on recent podcasts and so on and so forth, I'm not sure how up-to-date this is, but I'm going to go ahead, as always, and read now his Amazon author bio. Here we go. Check out cover art, updates, and more at chrisfoxwrites.com. By day, I am an iPhone developer architecting the app used to scope Stephen Colbert's ear. By night, I am Batman. Okay, maybe not. One can dream, though, right? I've been writing since I was 6 years old and started inflicting my work on others at age 18. By age 24, people stopped running away when I approached them with a new story, and shortly thereafter, I published my first one in the Rifter. Wait, you're still reading? Okay, the facts I'm supposed to list in a bio. As of this writing, I'm 38 years old and live just north of the Golden Gate Bridge in the beautiful town of Mill Valley. If you're unsure how to find it, just follow the smell of self-entitlement. Once you see the teens driving Teslas, you'll know you're in the right place. I live in a tiny studio that I can cross in literally 5 steps and don't own an oven. But you know what? It's worth it. I love developing iPhone apps. And if you want to work in San Francisco, you accept that rent for a tiny place costs more than most people's mortgage. If you and about 2 million other people start buying my books, I promise to move out to Marin, to a house in the Redwoods, up in Guerneville. No pressure. Wait, that's a lie. Pressure! All right, so there's Chris's Amazon author bio. And now I'm going to read his Amazon author rank beta. This is as of today, May 26th, 2017. Chris Fox, number 94 in Kindle eBooks, science fiction and fantasy, science fiction. So he's in the top 100 in the science fiction subset of science fiction and fantasy for the whole Kindle eBook store. Not too shabby, sir. Doing something right. Good. Chris doesn't just write sci-fi. In fact, part of his success is, as I've alluded, this big platform that he's been building for a few years. And included in that platform is a series of nonfiction titles aimed at authors. The series is called Write Faster, Write Smarter. There are 6 of these. I'm going to read these titles out loud. 5,000 Words Per Hour. Lifelong Writing Habit. Write to Market, Launch to Market, 6-Figure Author, and Relaunch Your Novel. And there are subtitles for all those as well. Check these books out if you haven't. First for the show today, you know, when I approached Chris, he was really cool. He said, yeah, go ahead, read anything of mine that you want, really. So I'm going to do a nonfiction reading to kick things off. Really different. I'm going to read just the introduction of Right to Market. Just the intro. So I'm not going to give away too many spoilers. You're still going to want to check out the book itself. But we're gonna hear that intro together. And then after that, we're going to move on to some of his fiction. So Chris has a few different fiction projects going on. He has, of course, his Deathless series, which is like a retelling of the old Universal monsters, you know, like the Wolfman and the Mummy. But then he also has the science fiction stuff that's going on. When he did his big writing challenge, Can I Write a Novel in 21 Days, a little over a year ago, that was the first in series for his first sci-fi trilogy, the Void Wraith trilogy. The book was called Destroyer, and I'm going to read the first chapter of that today as well. And I gotta say, I loved this book. It was fun. Man, talk about tight-knit pacing. It's amazing what writing a book that quickly does for your pacing. It's not a bad book at all. Some people say, oh, if you write that quick, is the quality going to suffer? No, if anything, the train of thought is unbroken. The momentum, you can feel it coming off the page. It's really, really cool. It's like a really, really fast-paced television show. I'm also going to read the first in series for his sequel trilogy called Behind the Lines. The trilogy is called The Genog Wars. Book one of that is Behind the Lines. I'm going to read the prologue of that today. And that is the first in series that he's doing a new YouTube series for right now called Three Novels in 3 Months, or is it Three Books in 3 Months, or Three Books in 90 Days? Something to that effect. So here's another part of Chris Fox's platform, his YouTube channel. Do yourself a favor. As soon as you're done listening to this episode, go to YouTube. Just look up Chris Fox. It'll be right near the top. And check out some of this guy's videos. Man, he is generous with his wealth of information. They're so inspiring. You get a feeling he's just giving away a lot of the information in his own books, in his nonfiction books. And that's one of the things I love about this guy. You can bet that if I'm going to go buy a series of marketing books, I'm going to buy Chris Fox's books because I trust this guy. I have seen it firsthand. Just the stuff that he puts out is really, really good, really high content. And of course, Chris also interacts with other author communities. He's in the 20 Books to 50K group. He's been on K-Boards for a long time. If you're on K-Boards and you haven't read a Chris Fox post, you need to have someone come over and inspect your house to see if it's a rock and get out from under that thing. Because this is some high-value content you should really check out. Lastly, before I do the readings, I want to remind everyone, as always, these readings do not come from an official audiobook. These are only my readings done for the purpose of this podcast, for your education and enjoyment. I did these with Chris's permission. It looks like there are audible narrations of Destroyer and of Right to Market. And because there is one of Destroyer, I assume one is forthcoming for Behind the Lines. So do check that out if you want the audiobook. Don't rely solely on this podcast. I want to say a big thank you to Chris for his permission to feature him today. A big thank you to you, the listener, for being here. And without any further ado, here we go. Right to Market, Destroyer, and Behind the Lines by Chris Fox. Right to Market. Deliver a book that sells. Write Faster, Write Smarter, Book 3, by Chris Fox. Introduction. If you've read 5,000 words per hour, or lifelong writing habit, you already know what to expect in this intro. I'm not going to spend 50 pages telling you all the things this book will do for you. I'm going to do it in one sentence. This book will teach you how to analyze the market and to use that information to write a book that readers want. Some of you are immediately skeptical. Others are grabbing pitchforks and torches. Writing to market has some nasty connotations, and we've all been taught that what it really means is that you're selling out. I'm here to tell you that absolutely is not the case. If you want to be a successful author, then you need to master your craft. You need to tell amazing stories. But the kind of story you choose to tell can dramatically affect your career as an author. There are two methods of writing a book. You can write, then market, or you can write to market. One has a much, much higher chance of success than the other. The first method is writing whatever story pops into your head. This might result in you writing something new and unique, something that takes off, like Harry Potter. Most likely, it will result in you writing a book that almost no one reads. Harsh, but accurate. The other method is contentious in the writing world. Many authors demonize writing to market, though I suspect very few really understand how or why it works. Writing to market is not copying Hunger Games and changing a few names and places. Hundreds of authors attempted to do exactly that, and the vast majority of their books failed. So, what is it? Writing to market is picking an underserved genre that you know has a voracious appetite, and then giving that market exactly what it wants. It means that before you write word one of your novel, you already know you're going to have fans waiting to buy it. That may seem impossible, but trust me when I say it is absolutely achievable. How do I know? Because I've utilized both methods. The first method served me fairly well, initially. My first novel was called No Such Thing as Werewolves. It turned several genres on their heads, and was quite unique. Readers responded favorably, and the series continues to be my top seller. So if the method was working, then why change it? Why start writing to market? Because I later realized that I'd accidentally written No Such Thing as Werewolves to market. That wasn't clear until I attempted my first spin-off. I launched a second series called Hero Born that I touted as X-Files meets Heroes. I was immensely proud of it. It was unique and fun, and I assumed readers would love it. I had a large mailing list, an understanding of marketing and advertising, and a broad platform I used to launch the book. The series sank like a rock, and the only people who bought it were loyal readers who loved my deathless books. Everyone else ignored it, and 3 months later, it still hasn't earned back what it cost to produce. If I followed the conventional wisdom offered in writing forums like K-Boards, I'd try to advertise the book. I'd try price pulsing. I'd mess with keywords. Maybe I'd change the cover. I'd monkey with the blurb. You know what? I didn't do any of those things because I understood immediately why the book failed. I didn't write it to market. I wrote it, then tried to market it. At the same time I launched Hero Born, my friend Domino Finn launched a book called Dead Man. Dead Man was an urban fantasy written to market. It followed all the genre tropes and is a slightly darker version of the Dresden Files. Fans loved it, and while my book sank, Dead Man took off. Nor was it the only book I saw do that. Dawn McKenna published a wonderful literary novel called See You. If you want a good cry, read the book. It's amazing. Very few people bought CU, and Dawn was in a rough financial spot. She decided to try something else. Dawn worked with powerhouse Wayne Stinnett, who all but owns the sea adventure genre. Dawn wrote a series to market, and went from 2 figures a month to hitting 5 figures a month. R.M. Webb did the same thing. So did Katie Vance. The list of authors who transitioned into the writing-to-market model is long, and you'll hear more about them through the course of this book. So, I decided to do it too. My first attempt was a book many of you have read. 5,000 words per hour was written to market. I looked around at the nonfiction space and realized there was room for another book on writing faster. But this is the real rub, the thing many people get wrong. You can't just rehash a successful book. That way lies disaster. I didn't copy Rachel Aaron's 2K to 10K. Instead, I figured out what problem she was solving, and solved the same problem in my own way. My book reads differently than others like it. It's shorter, more concise, and offers exercises at the end of every chapter. None of the others did that. I hit the same tropes other successful books have hit, but I made sure to do it in my voice and in my own way. If the idea of tropes is new, don't worry. I'll explain what they are and how to analyze them for your genre. All you need to know right now is that before you start writing your next novel, you need to understand the market you plan to aim it at. So, how about it? Have I piqued your interest? If so, open up the book and let's get cracking. Destroyer. Book 1 in The Void Wraith Trilogy by Chris Fox. Chapter 1. Debris. Commander Nolan ducked through the hatch into the Combat Information Center of the UFC Johnston. It was smaller than he was used to, the consoles set closer to each other than they'd been back at the Office of Fleet Intelligence. 7 people made the room positively claustrophobic, and he imagined that this was what sailors had experienced aboard submarines just a few centuries past. "Captain, we're clearing the sun's corona. Inductive field down to 12%. I'm bringing thrusters online," Emo called over his shoulder in a strange southern drawl, completely at odds with his appearance. Waif thin and pale, he wore black lipstick and white makeup. The left side of his head had been shaved, while the shiny black hair on the right side drooped over his face. He sat near the far end of the CIC, his simple chrome chair aimed at the view screen. That view screen showed the most breathtaking vista Nolan had ever seen. Pillars of flame, hundreds of miles high, shot up around them, more than one coming perilously close to their destroyer-class vessel. Emo deftly maneuvered around the flares, slowly gaining distance from the star. The fact that it was even possible to escape a sun's gravitational pull was nothing short of miraculous, But the Helios drives made it commonplace. They simply harnessed the sun's own energy.
"Commander, are you going to join us?" called a gruff voice.
Nolan turned toward the voice, which had come from a chair on the opposite side of the room, one that was set a little higher than the rest, a subtle reminder that the person sitting there was in charge. In this case, that person was a short man in his early 60s, a person Nolan had revered his whole life. The legendary Captain Dryker, hero of the Tigris War. His white beard was scraggly, and his hair hadn't seen a brush since Nolan had boarded 3 days past. But the captain's eyes were sharp, and his leanly muscled physique was still that of a much younger officer.
"Yes, sir," Nolan said, realizing he was still standing just inside the narrow hatchway.
He threaded between the communication consoles, wishing he knew the names of the two techs working there. He stepped up next to the captain's chair, folding his hands behind his back.
"You're 2 minutes early," the captain said, though his eyes were fixed on the view screen.
"Yes, sir. I prefer being early," Nolan said, though he had the impression that the captain wasn't really listening.
"Captain?" Emo called, spinning his chair to face them. "You're going to want to see this. Check grid 729, sir."
"Noted," Dryker said, scanning a data pad sitting in his lap. He loosened the collar of his uniform, revealing a coffee stain on the cotton shirt underneath. Nolan waited for several moments while the captain scanned. Dryker finally looked up, meeting Nolan's gaze.
"What do you make of this, Commander?"
He handed the pad to Nolan, who quickly scanned the data.
"It's a debris field, sir. From the alloy, I'd suggest it's probably the remains of a Tigris vessel. It's smaller than I'd expect, though. A science vessel, maybe?"
"Very good," Dryker replied, giving a tight nod. "And what can you deduce from the situation?"
Nolan was silent as he glanced between the view screen and the data pad. There were a lot of disparate pieces, but he knew they added up to something. Something the captain was already aware of.
"There was a battle, and that battle was recent. Tigris don't generally send their science vessels outside their own space. And they certainly don't send them to a human colony like Marcona."
"Good, but there's a more urgent fact you're missing," Dryker said, eyeing Nolan frostily.
Nolan resisted the urge to blush. He'd only been aboard the Johnston for a few days, and didn't mind admitting that the war hero intimidated him.
"Sir?"
"The debris is close. Maybe 300,000 clicks from the sun's corona," Dryker supplied, raising an eyebrow.
"Ah, I should have caught that," Nolan replied, finally understanding. He tensed. "The battle was recent. Very recent. If this had happened even a few hours ago, the debris field would have already been pulled in by the sun's gravity."
"The Johnston had cleared the corona,
and was accelerating toward the debris field. As they approached, the view screen's magnification shifted to provide a close-up. Large chunks of bronze-colored alloy floated in space, sinking gradually closer to the sun.
"Set condition one throughout the ship," Dreiker barked.
A blonde lieutenant in her early 20s gave a quick nod and a murmured response. Then the lighting changed. The bright halogens faded to soft red, and a single warning klaxon rang across the deck. Nolan had never seen a ship of the line enter combat readiness, but he'd been trained for it back at the academy. He moved a step to the left, clipping himself to a handle on the side of the bulkhead.
"Captain, do you think whoever did this is still here? Wouldn't we be able to see them?" Nolan asked. It might be a stupid question, but he was genuinely curious.
"It's possible they could have retreated back into the sun, and they may have already used the Helios gate,"
Dreiker conceded, his eyes never leaving the view screen.
"I don't think so, though. I'm guessing they're still in the system. Emo, give me a system scan. Where could a vessel run to?"
"There are only two real choices," Emo said. "They could go for that asteroid field that used to be a moon, or they could be hiding in Marcona's shadow."
"They'd have to be damned quick to make it to the planet already," Dreiker said, rising from his chair and crossing the deck to stand next to Emo.
Nolan considered following, but chose to stay clipped to the bulkhead.
"Sir, if they are in the asteroid field, what are we planning to do about it?" Nolan asked.
"Captain," the blonde snapped, drawing Nolan's attention. Her blue eyes had gone wide.
"Another vessel is emerging from the Helios gate. It's clearing the sun's corona now. It's broadcasting an ident. Looks to be a Tigris warship."
"Battle stations," Dreiker barked.
Behind the lines. Ganog Wars, Book 1, by Chris Fox. Prologue. Takar hopped from his command disk, waving it away as he swept into the stasis chamber. He glanced at the trio of Saurian slave guards, each giving a cringing bow, and clenched his lower nostrils shut to blot out the stench of their fear. They hurried from the chamber, leaving Takar alone, save for a single gray-robed techsmith and the prisoner. That prisoner hovered near the center of the room, suspended by the translucent red bonds around her wrists and ankles. Her pale skin had almost no fur, though a mane of black hair grew from her head. Takar was moderately surprised by her defiant glare, something he'd not seen from an enemy in a long time. Where was the cowering? The pleading?
"Techsmith!" Takar bellowed, scowling at the door.
The green-scaled Saurian scurried forward, clenching her arcanatome to her chest. Purple circuitry covered the dark surface, sending pulses of data
up the cord leading to her temple. The sight of it sickened Takar, and he loathed the need for such servants. He turned back to the prisoner, studying the strange, pale-skinned creature. It had two arms and two legs, like a Gnog or Saurian, yet it had no fur or scales, and its hide had proven extremely fragile. Even a casual fall would shatter its bones. "This human," he said, "what language does it speak? Can we communicate with it?" "The creature is capable of communication, clan leader," the techsmith murmured. She shrank into her robes when Takar shifted a disapproving eye in her direction. "This species has quite cleverly modified one of their own genes using a viral agent. It allows anyone infected to understand the speech of any other infected creature by attaching a biotranslation unit to the language centers of the brain." "Are you suggesting we've been infected by an alien virus?" Takar's voice was deadly quiet, and his fur darkened to black. She cringed, backing away slowly. "The techsmiths have deemed the virus safe, clan leader. It is an airborne pathogen, but it only modifies a single specific gene. We have both been exposed, as has every other techsmith who initially examined the subject." Takar flared his lower nostrils, and his fur returned to a rich scarlet. "How long since the initial exposure?"
17 hours, clan leader. The physiological changes were completed within the first hour. Krakon probed her, and he believes the virus is harmless."
The techsmith's retreat was finally halted by the wall of the stasis chamber. She huddled there, waiting for judgment.
"So she can understand what we're saying," Takar said.
He studied the prisoner, finding comprehension in those defiant eyes.
"Yes, she definitely knows what we're saying. She's studying us. That implies a certain amount of intelligence. Did her species design the fleet we destroyed? Or did they scavenge it from another species? It seemed more advanced than I'd expect from such a simple creature."
"We believe her species constructed the vessels."
Tangy fear wafted from the techsmith as Takar folded furry arms large enough to snap her neck.
"They seem to have no distinction between castes. Their techsmiths travel with their soldiers, and their leadership caste seems comprised entirely of soldiers who were elevated into the position."
"You know I can understand you," the human said. Her voice was a higher tenor than Takar had expected, even given her diminutive size.
"If you want to know about our culture, why not just ask? Why attack us without provocation? We'd done nothing to you, yet you brutally assaulted our fleet."
The techsmith sucked in a breath, her fiery eyes widening, then quickly narrowing again.
"You have addressed the clan leader of the Kash, Katok. If you speak again..."
"Silence."
Takar waved a hand, and the techsmith's jaw clicked shut.
He leaned closer to the human.
It's that simple, then, with your species? I tell you why we attacked, and you answer my questions?
I have nothing to hide, and I don't understand our technology well enough to tell you anything I shouldn't.
Determination thickened in the human's gaze.
You can torture me, or you can tell me what I want to know, and deal with a far more cooperative subject.
Very well. Takar gave her a toothy smile, leaning closer. If you answer my questions, I will answer yours. Given that your position is rather dubious, why don't you allow me to ask my questions first?
The human hesitated. She studied Takar for long moments, her lips pursed. All right. Takar repeated his earlier question, this time directing it to the human.
Did your species design the fleet we destroyed?
Yes. My species helped design our weapons and ships.
Helped? Takar asked, his interest growing. There was another species aboard your vessel, and your communications archives make mention of a third. What is your relationship to these races? What can you tell me about them?
They're our allies, part of the Coalition of United Species, the human explained. The larger aliens are called the Tigris. They're some of our fiercest warriors and best scientists. The smaller race are the Primo. Their science is the most advanced, but we've been catching up quickly with their help.
The Primo. Takar tasted the words. In your language, that means the first. These Primo are the oldest race?
Yes.
Yet all of you share equally in this coalition? Takar asked.
Our leader is of my species, the woman explained. President Dreiker will only serve for 2 more years, though. Then it's possible we may elect a Tigris or Primo to replace him. Her posture had relaxed, suggesting her fear had ebbed. Interesting. This seemed a trusting species.
I'm not sure I understand, Takar said. This Dreiker will simply relinquish power, and someone else will take his place?
He turned back to the techsmith, who quivered meekly in his shadow.
Have we ever seen anything like this before?
Yes, clan leader, the techsmith replied quickly. The Hualorians exhibited just such a government when we conquered them 17 centuries ago. It's part of the reason their resistance was so ineffectual. They were paralyzed by weak leadership. If that characterization bothered the human, she didn't show it. She merely stared impassively at Takar. Takar considered his next question carefully. How much would this human reveal?
Why have you entered this sector? It is the property of the Ganog Imperium, and one of our most far-flung provinces. Do you seek to invade?
We're explorers, she explained with an exasperated sigh. We came here searching for the Gorthians, a race of planet-sized eyes that reproduce through a slug-like parasite. They attacked our sector of the galaxy, wiping out many of our people. After we defeated them, all 3 races banded together and vowed to hunt them down.
We want to make sure the Gorthians never hurt anyone again.
Ah, now that is a sentiment my species can understand.
Takar smiled broadly.
You seek vengeance for their attacks. Is that it?
Exactly.
Takar gave a rumbling laugh. You've done exactly as I asked. Now I will honor our accord. What do you wish to know, human?
Why did you attack us? She asked.
Because the Ganag are conquerors, and you have yet to be subjugated. My clan will plunder your worlds for labor slaves and tech smiths. If you have weapons, we will take them. If you have wealth, we will seize it.
Have you another question?
Takar licked his lips, inhaling deeply of the woman's earthy scent. His stomachs rumbled. The woman licked her lips as well, evidently gathering her thoughts. Do you recognize the Gorthians?
Possibly. A monstrous eye is mentioned in our earliest myths. It is one of the nameless ones from our most ancient legends.
It isn't a myth, I can promise you that. This thing devoured billions of people before we burned it to a crisp.
The woman stood as straight as her bonds would allow.
We don't have to fight. We have a common foe. Help us find the Gorthians, and we'll help you kill them.
You misunderstand, human. I said I recognized them, not that I considered them enemies. Our seekers are quite clear on that point. To oppose the Nameless Ones is to die. All we can do is seek to avoid their terrible gaze. Even were that not so, my people are conquerors. We will add your might to our own. If the day comes when we must oppose a Nameless One, your world will already be dust.
Takar clicked his tongue, and the techsmith shot to her feet. He turned to her.
Have Krakon conduct a final interrogation. After he's taken all he can from her mind, have her prepared for tonight's feast.
The Saurian eyed the prisoner critically.
Forgive me, clan leader, but she does not possess very much meat. Shall I have some of the others prepared as well?
Do that.
Takar turned an appraising eye back on the prisoner.
You said that their soldiers have some kind of transponder, he said, a plan taking shape.
Indeed, clan leader. They are utilizing some sort of quantum entanglement to transmit data. The transponders are capable of broadcasting a location, but we've blocked the signal.
Have the transponders moved to the local Colosseum, then remove the quantum dampeners. Move the planet striders into position and assemble the mounds.
He met the human's defiant gaze and he smiled.
This coalition will come for their people, and when they do, we will be waiting. One of those ships will have star charts, and after we have them, we can begin conquest in earnest.
This concludes another episode of the Book Speaks podcast, where the book speaks for itself. Thanks for joining me, your host, Benjamin Douglas, for another indie author reading. If you liked what you heard, be sure to visit http://thebookspeakspodcast.wordpress.com for more episodes and for links to the author's website and the author's Amazon author page in the show notes. If you'd like to follow me on my own author journey, you can find me at http://benjamindouglasbooks.wordpress.com. And of course, if you're an indie author interested in having your work featured on the show, or if you're interested in discussing having your book read and produced by me as an audiobook, feel free to contact me at benjamindouglasbooks@gmail.com. Thanks for joining me today. I hope you have a productive and enjoyable weekend.